Reggie, I hearing you talk, I was making a comment to Jordan because we went to seminary together, and I was telling him I can't remember one seminary class that I took where the focus was on developing the kind of kingdom-oriented leaders and disciples in the church that you're talking about. Hmm. And so our entire educational system for pastors is set up to do something totally different than what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So just now, can you unpack for me and talk a little bit more, what do you think the shifts are that we need to make? What are the questions we need to ask to start to begin to develop that kind of kingdom-oriented disciple?
Well, you know, it's such a great question. What we're talking about here is actually people's lives being transformed. Mm-hmm. You know, not enlightened, you know, not educated. I mean, there's nothing wrong with those, but those stop way short of transformation. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the questions we need to ask ourselves is, what kind of environment is required to foster life transformation? I'll give you an example of one way that I helped a group of people, or I tried to introduce this question to them. Six teams of church staff folks that I had called together around this, and we went to a CrossFit box. Is that what they call it? Yeah. That work. It looks like a torture chamber to me. But so we go into this CrossFit space, and I had the coach there, and that's what they call him. He's a coach.
Yeah.
And because people's lives, particularly at that time, it was really a popular deal, and people were changing. It was changing people's lives, and they were talking about it. I said, mm-hmm. "Tell us what happens in here that you get that kind of rave response of people getting up before God, you know, and going down and, you know, before they go to work and all that kind of stuff." And so he just talked about, you know, different elements of a CrossFit experience that helped to be transformative, like, you know, like accountability. And I mean, everybody in there, goal setting. I mean, but that's part of goal setting, is the whole accountability. You've declared in front of God and everybody, this is what you want to do. But then you're not left to do it on your own. You don't go through CrossFit by yourself. You've got a partner in there, and you know, and you've got a coach who's helping you, you know, do it. And I mean, he just went through elements after that. So I think far too often our discipling efforts, like you say, we've created students. And so it's a classroom model. It's pretty, you know, everybody knows the answers to the questions. And we just traipse through this stuff instead of opening life up for examination. You know, life is the curriculum, not the printed. And I've written curriculum. It's some of the best curriculum, maybe the best curriculum that's ever been written as I think about it. But it would actually change the world if only I would do it. You know what I'm saying? So, I mean, there's such a gap between that kind of academic, we should and we must and don't we all, versus the reality of life, which is where Jesus always was, you know, the reality stuff. And he put his disciples in situations that were uncomfortable on purpose. Well, most churches is we're trying to reduce comfort. We're trying to reduce uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I mean, the American dream is not to have pain, you know, and to avoid suffering and all that. We want to help with that here at our church. Yeah. So we're going to inoculate you and isolate you from the pain that's going on. So I think we ought to ask her, what are the elements? I think, too, we need to, I think in the church there was this idea that we have evangelism, then people cross over, and then we start discipleship. We've got to start thinking about discipling people way before they are believers. I mean, if we're into developing people, which I think is, Jesus did. Mm-hmm. Jesus started developing people well before they declared, you know, faith or whatever in him. I just think we've got to quit figuring out how to turn people into church people first, and then we can disciple them. that's why when we do ministries in the community or schools, or we've got to be ready to have, to give an answer for the hope that's in us, even as we're ministering to people well before. I mean, they don't have to sign up for the 14-week course. We from the get-go, we've got to be thinking about when we engage people, how are we helping them grow into the life that God wants for them? For me, that's what discipleship is. And we got to figure out how to engage people then in that regard. If they don't have to be church people first, we've got to figure out how to engage people who are not susceptible to being congregationalized. There are so many people whose life rhythms don't match a congregational rhythm, which every 7 days we go through a whole business cycle, you know, in the church. And that's not how I live my life. And that's not how most folks live their lives. I mean, you know, we have different cycles in people's, I mean, there are people that, well, it doesn't matter. So that congregational rhythm, there are a lot of people that just doesn't make sense to them. Yeah. Doesn't fit their lifestyle, their availability, or any of that. And so we got to figure out how to, and of course, that means we have to be available to them on a more, kind of more of a DVR approach, you know, rather than, you know, the old live TV. Right now, most churches are operating their discipleship live TV. If you don't get here, mm-hmm. you know, and if you don't get it when we do it, mm. you miss it. We could be smarter than this. We've got to have resources available to people when they're ready, when they need it. You know,
we really don't want people skipping 30 seconds ahead every time we get to the offer.
We need to excel. Yeah. If you could just leave your card number on file with us, we're heavily protected against hackers, we think. The other thing that people need to know if they're going to be transformed, they need to know they're growing. People want to know, am I developing? You know, again, this goes back to all kinds of stuff about internal motivation and everything else. I mean, I've been on a diet most of my life. I mean, I've talked about, you know, food a good bit on our episodes here. I've probably lost 3,000 pounds is my best estimation, you know. And, you know, but the truth is I can talk about it a lot. But my wife, and you know, knows I'm really serious about it when I start getting on the scales. When I start weighing, which, by the way, I'm not done here recently, but the point is, if I really want to track my development, there's no other way to do that.
Yeah,
you know, maybe my pants feel a little better. I can fool myself into believing they've, because they've, you know, whatever. But you know, people want to know that they're growing, and I say, why not ask how many better marriages we have? Whatever it is. In fact, I did a church consult once where we interviewed about 900 people in the church over what we called real life. What would you like to see God do in your life over the next 6 months, we asked. And it's amazing. People actually have dreams and desires. They would like to see God do stuff in there. Now, in the typical program church, we don't have to ask that question because we know what God wants to do in the life of our folks. We've already planned our sermon series out by that and everything, and that's going to be a capital campaign and all that. Are you kidding? You know, when people get a chance to declare, this is where I need help.
Yeah.
And then we have a chance that, but don't, in case you're thinking about it, don't do that. Well, if you're going to start that, you have to stay with it. In other words, so how's that going? How's that working for you? So another church client I'm working with right now is in the process of asking those questions, but integrating that into all their small group stuff, you know, so that people get to come back. I mean, you go to the doc for an annual physical, you take your car in forever. Why don't I know if I'm growing spiritually? It's like, shouldn't I be able to celebrate that I've made some progress this year spiritually? I mean, it's years ago. Remember that study that was put out by a well-known church? I don't want to talk about them. You know, that it was a discipleship study,
yeah.
And we measured people on all of these, you know, scales of stuff like that. And I said, and I told every one of my clients, don't do it. I mean, if you're going to do that, get you a bag of Prozac. when the results come out, because we have spent years telling people, you don't pray enough, give enough, you know, visit enough, serve enough. And then we ask them, do you pray enough? Do you visit enough? What do you expect people to tell us? No, I'm not near the, well, it's always going to come back on a deficit, you know, like that. Why not flip this script and give people a chance to talk about where they're making progress? Yeah. And, you know, I mean, anyway, so, but what do I know? I'd like to see our churches, congregations, just be that kind of life-centric. And I think probably maybe that's the last thing that I would say is we got to keep asking ourselves, what's the narrative that underpins all of our discipling efforts? Are we really just trying to fix people? Is this sin management? Is that our goal? I don't know about you. Well, probably I do know about you. You probably need a lot of that. But in my case, you know, I've just grown past that. And so, you know, I need another narrative. And the narrative, to close the circle, to go all the way back up to the top of our discussion.
Yeah.
You know, people come from the heart and the mind of God, helping people experience life. That, what else is there? I mean, what are we waiting for?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, why would we postpone living or postpone that kind of deal? So let's accelerate people's capacity to enjoy life. That's the point. And then celebrate the heck out of it.
Yeah. You gave some really good, great concrete examples earlier when we were talking about the scorecard, like some things we could change on the scorecard. Do you have some similar thoughts when it comes to this kind of thing, in terms of people being able to have almost their own personal scorecard about their spiritual growth? Are there some things that you have in mind that we as pastors should be more mindful of as we kind of develop this relational discipleship model of recognizing growth?
Well, I am in early stages with some of these kind of interview approaches, coaching, building a coaching environment, mm-hmm. with some of my clients, where we're really specific about letting people self-declare, this is where I need help. But I'm also trying to build into those kinds of conversations the capacity to roll that information up. I don't mean name by name, but if you've got 30 people that are saying, you know, we need help here, then you don't have to go on a vision quest, you know, and smoke peyote to figure out what should we be doing here. You know, I mean, you know, this is the kind of information that really could help drive pastoral engagement from that point of view. But I'm not far enough along to say that I've got folks that are walking around with scorecards or report cards and they're doing really well. I would just say, I think the most important thing is, I don't care what your questions are, but that we're letting people begin to participate in their own recovery. Mm. You know, and to me, however you get that done, I'm all for you. And I because people got to become people.
Yeah. Good. I love it.
That's all I got. I don't even have that. That's all I got.
Yeah.
Now, I don't have no idea how to do this stuff. I'm just talking.
Well, I think that some of this stuff...
Should I say that?
Well, I think some of the stuff you're talking about right now, it's almost... We could create metrics we could measure with some of the scorecard stuff you're talking about as an institution, right?
Yeah.
Tell me how many hours you spent in community services last quarter. Turn in a form that says that. How many times a week have you been praying on average? You know, those kinds of things. But this kind of stuff you're talking about with discipleship, it's so relational that it almost has to be customizable to each person, and it's hard to create like some kind of sets of metrics because it's more intuitive. It's because of the relationship we have. So it's more, I think maybe it's more about how do we train the right leaders who are going to mentor and disciple, so that they can have that intuitiveness about how to feed back to the people they're mentoring. Mm-hmm. Here's growth I see in you.
Yes.
That you're telling me.
And then that becomes a way that, and people can inculcate that then into their own lives, where they're dealing with their kids that way, they're dealing with themselves that way. Hmm. You know, those are learned particularly feedback loop, debrief versus, you know, deliver, you know, didactic. And boy, people are so awash in information that they really need help connecting dots. Hmm. And they're living their lives, and they're not even seeing the dots of, where's this taking me, you know, and where, you know, what's going on in my life that I know is going on, but I don't know what's going on, mm-hmm. because I'm not taking time to reflect, you know, on because life is just so crammed full of stuff. And I think this is particularly, it's truer. Now this sounds generationally biased, but I think it is more a challenge the younger you go, because millennials are growing up in a world where information is so accessible. No one's ever, many of them have not had someone, for lots of reasons, whether it's broken homes or lack of relational mentors or whatever else, make sense out of any of the information. And which information should I pay attention to, and what gets jettisoned? What's really important? Figuring out, that's called judgment. Well, judgment is not something you teach in a classroom. I mean, that requires lots of conversation and life on life stuff. I just think we're getting more back to a very ancient way of developing people, which is that. It's life on life,
yeah.
You know, kind of stuff.
Which, again, that's another kingdom countercultural narrative.
Yes, yes.
The cultural direction that we're going now is about, is it illegal or is it legal? If it's illegal, then I won't do it. If it's legal, I will do it. Whereas what you're talking about in judgment, I have to make a decision. Is this good for me or not, regardless of the legality of it? But we've broken everything down to these simple sets of rules. If you could just do the things by the rules, then you'll be okay. And so we've gotten rid of judgment in a lot of places.
Totally. And I'll tell you, a lot of congregations are full of people who know, who have fabulous judgment, and they're sitting there feeling like they have nothing to offer their communities. Hmm. And they're wondering, how can we get young people here? And we don't know how to talk to them. And I mean, and they are the treasures.
Yeah.
If they could be repositioned in their own mind, I don't mean as super people, I mean, but just if we could form, and I'll tell you, community engagement will put them in touch with the millennials. The millennials, give up on trying to get millennials to come to church. Just give up on that. Mm-hmm. I mean, now some of them may make a mistake and turn in at the wrong time and show up, but they're not trolling for a church. They're, you know, so let's just find the church with the right coffee, you know, and a real sexy sax player at the right time. I mean, are you kidding? This is so ridiculous, you know, and this is only church people could come up with stuff like this. You know, let's just fix it so they'll come.
Yeah.
Go. Engage in the community, and you're going to wind up shoulder to shoulder with these folks. And then out of those relationships, I mean, we've seen this happen even inside the church, even in our generationally siloed discipleship, but then churches send mission groups off, you know, like disaster relief and all that. And these 16-year-olds come back best buds with these 68-year-olds because they've been repairing a roof together all week. Suddenly you got a whole new dynamic going on. What part of this did we miss?
Yeah.
This is what we need. This is what the kids need. This is what the 68-year-old needs.
Yeah.
You know, gosh. And so I wish I could just help a lot of churches that feel like, well, we just got a bunch of old people here. We're going, good.
Yeah.
Now let's unbundle these assets.
Yeah. I think another thing that we've done, and I'd love to hear you reflect and talk on this, is we have so poorly as pastors helped our sheep, whatever, you know, our parishioners understand the movement of God in their lives in a way that they can recognize it as the movement of God. I'll tell this story. A woman in my church who was in her 90s, one of the most beautiful human beings I've ever met. She recently passed. And when I came to the church, I would ask a question of people, who in the church has had a spiritual impact on you? Who has had an impact on your spirituality just from your interaction with them? And an overwhelmingly large number of people in the 70s and 80s crowd mentioned this woman. And she was a regular in my midweek Bible study, and we were talking one time about recognizing the movement of God in your life. And she said to me in the group, "You know, Chris, I don't think God's ever really moved in my life."
Wow.
And I was like blown away, because her name was the name that everybody else had said. But it wasn't a problem of her not having God move in her life. It was a problem that she had never been told how to do it. She, after weeks of us having discussions about this, she later came to me and she started telling me some stories of how she was remembering how God had moved in her life. And it was just amazing.
That was a gift to her.
Yeah. Yeah. So where have you recognized maybe some pastors who are doing this really well? And what do you think are some of the traits that we can learn from them in terms of how they're helping people recognize how God's moving in their life?
I'm sure I'll give a much better answer than I'm about to give you on the plane headed home. I've never had anyone ask me that. I will say there are qualities of those people. I find that authentic people are more likely to be able to see some of this because they're in touch with their own stuff. And that's not a great answer, but it seems to me that I would think that's the key. I mean, they're authentic and they have emotional intelligence, so they're able to connect with people. They're high in empathy, or they act like it. I tell leaders, even if you don't have it, act like it. People receive it just the same way. because empathy is a really important, not sympathy, but empathy is really important in being able to walk into other people's lives. And probably I'd say I'm thinking of qualities more than a specific example.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm around great people a lot, and I'm sure a lot of these are having that kind of impact, but I'm kind of in and out, so I don't see the day-to-day, month-to-month. Probably the last thing I'd say about it is they themselves see themselves as a work in progress. And so they're always looking for, progress as well as where do I need to grow? And they're authentic about it, so they're transparent. Doesn't mean they use the pulpit as a counselor. It's all about them. But people know that they're on a genuine quest, and that helps free other people. They've not arrived. It's like Paul. I'm not there yet. But I don't know why we entered a period of time where our clergy, it's like you're supposed to be the super person, and not have any of your own foibles and stuff to deal with, and that's what will qualify you as a spiritual leader. It's exactly what disqualifies you as a spiritual leader, because you're faking it. I remember there was this guy that it was 2 years I'd worked with him. He's a newspaper journalist, and I wrote an article every week for the little newspaper in our town, and I would always deliver the article in person so we could have coffee, and I could just talk to him, because he was very interested spiritually. He's not a church person at all. And I did have the opportunity to be part of his conversion, in his middle age life. About 2 or 3 weeks after he became a Jesus follower, we were having coffee again. He said, "It must be nice." I said, "What?" He said, "Man, you've been a Christian so long. It must be nice you're not having to deal with temptation like that." I just said, "Wait a minute." I said, "I don't want you suffering under this illusion." I said, "Honestly, we're just now getting to the hard stuff. Not chewing or going with girls that do. That was pretty early on, but now I'm really getting down to the hardcore kind of, biases and prejudices and stuff like that." So I think if you have an awareness like that, it can kind of free people up around you to, not that I was that I mean, I guess I was pretty perfect for those folks, as I think back over.
Well, and the irony of
let me give you their names. I can tell you more.
The irony of what you're talking about, too, I think beautifully fits into Next Generations, is what I've found, you know, being kind of in the upper age of millennials, is millennials and younger generations really, really value authenticity.
Oh.
It's the anti-institutionalism.
It's the entry card. You don't even... It's the access to the vault. I mean, you don't get... It's the password that opens up,
yeah,
you know, the system. Otherwise, you don't get in. Yeah. And, you know, I agree with them.
Yeah.